are the update on the statewide cannabis cultivation waste discharge pilot regulatory and enforcement program. And I did want to reaffirm, I'm sort of a broken record on it, that I'm not sure the regional board has signed on to calling it a cannabis cultivation regulation program. I think we're looking at it as otherwise unregulated ag, or at least that's a board issue in the future is how we title it. But obviously the press likes this. This is the sexy way to title it. I realize that that's probably how it'll be referred to, but we may or may not want to be more neutral and not directly regulated.
The MJ or the pot unit anyway, please.
Yeah.
Mr.
So with
Chair.
That, we're happy to call on the update. And we appreciate it that we have an update to report back to us, because that's starting to move pretty fast from when we started.
And Mr. Chair, I'd actually recommend that we take the update on our enforcement program first, and then
okay.
Then
I
after
stand
that,
corrected. Thank you.
It's okay.
I appreciate your sense, Chair Corbett, of trying to move the agenda along quickly.
I'm happy to get mine.
And with that, good morning, honorable board members. Executive staff. I'm Chris Kerrigan, Director of the State Water Board's Office of Enforcement. I'm here to address you briefly about our enforcement program. I really want to also give props to Matt and his staff for the visioning, strategic visioning. We have a very small role to play in that with respect to the enforcement component. You'll see how we've been really working with your staff on that. On that level, and it's very exciting to see that work moving into the future. So without further ado, let's see here. Oh, let's see, do we need to go back to four?
No,
oh,
you're okay.
Item five, enforcement update, okay.
I was gonna introduce you, but we made it through that slide.
I jumped ahead of her.
Continue on.
I was infectious in that regard.
So we are, at the State Water Board's Office of Enforcement, we have four really focused priorities for this year. The drinking water program, as you know, has come into our fold. We are charged with representing them in enforcement actions. There's a lot of challenges there. You may know that the drinking water program regulates laboratories that certify environmental data for all the BDOs, including us. And so now they're in our shop, so we have a responsibility for overseeing labs that certify environmental data. In addition to the drinking water purveyors, and also then I'll talk a little bit more detail about some of the challenges we have there. We're focused on replacement water orders in nitrate-impacted disadvantaged communities. So we're using our authority under Water Code 13304, primarily in the Central Coast and Central Valley, to focus on addressing impacted drinking water from nitrate and agricultural practices. The Cannabis Cultivation Initiative, and for us at the state, it is a cannabis cultivation initiative. The regulatory component is one component of that, which can be broader or more general, as Mr. Corbett described it. But we're focused on education and outreach to the regulated public that is focused on cannabis cultivators, and then multi-agency coordination with local and state partners and federal agencies, and then also with enforcement in that program. So whatever form your permit takes, that's the regional board's purview, but we do have a cannabis initiative that is a component of. And then finally, we're really focused on the drought, and of course, it's not out there by itself, mutually exclusive. It is sort of an overlay of our other problems and issues. It's certainly impacting drinking water supplies in disadvantaged communities. It's impacted species habitat here. And when you look at it combined with other activities that are going on, it's really having an acute impact. So our office is really focused on these four things, in addition to the regular work we do in all of the other programs for 2015. The drinking water program, we're looking at replacement water orders pursuant to the human right to drinking water, and then also our groundwater strategic plan. In our report to the legislature on behalf of all the boards, we identify that replacement water orders are one of the things we can use, one of our existing tools to help solve the nitrate problems. It's a very limited tool since agricultural contribution to groundwater aquifers can be fairly ubiquitous and difficult to map to a certain responsible party. And also because in many areas, it's difficult to identify disadvantaged communities who are impacted if they have private wells or are on private systems where we don't have good data. And so there's a lot of outreach to NGOs like the Clean Water Alliance, Rural Assistance League, and others, non-governmental organizations, to try to figure out who are the people that really need our help to get replacement water. Also, I talked a little bit about the ELAP, the Lab Certification Program. Much like our cleanup fund, we have identified several labs that are engaged in fraudulent practices. We're going to be decertifying a few labs in the near term and seeking fines and penalties. And then we also have a lot of sloppy lab practices. So with the independent enforcement arm, we're able to go out with the drinking water people and really look at these labs and make sure that the compliance data that we're getting from them is meaningful. We did an inspection at one lab. They didn't even have the equipment necessary to perform the test required by the EPA regulations for the data that they were reporting. So we find that there hasn't been a strong history of policing or enforcement in this area, so we're working very closely on that. And then also in the drinking water program, I don't know if you know this, but 15 to 50 connections. Many of the programs from 15 to 50 are delegated to counties for enforcement and oversight. We have some counties, one in particular, where all they did was take our money. They didn't even track data at these systems. They did no enforcement, no data tracking, no regulatory oversight whatsoever. So the Division of Drinking Water now is looking at the county programs with a fresh eye, deciding, should this county really be in charge of these public drinking water systems between 15 and 150 folks? Some counties do a really bang-up job, no question about it. It's just that we haven't had a real audit of the various counties, and in some counties, they're just not looking at this issue. In the cannabis cultivation area, we have kind of, as I described before, a four-part project. And, of course, development of a regulatory program is going to be something that we're really looking to the board for guidance on. Your board is out in the lead on this. Your staff has done a really excellent job. It's a very complicated area of the law and of regulation, new frontier in many ways, and yet in many ways we have many of the tools that we need available. It's just gathering them together into the right toolbox. And Samantha Olson, Matt St. John have been doing just a bang-up job on that, and your region is out in the lead on this, along with the Central Valley region, who's going to be dragged along behind you a few months behind. And then targeted enforcement, and by targeted, I mean proactive enforcement in impacted watersheds. So we're looking at high-value watersheds with private property owners where we can go in and work with them to attain a system-wide or sub-watershed-wide solution to water supply and water quality issues in those areas. And I'll talk at length about this in the next item or at some length. Education and outreach is a really critical component. We need to make sure that we're getting as much compliance assistance and information out there to the cultivators who want to comply with environmental laws and regulations that are on the books now. And there, we're finding that there's a very large segment of the population that's hungry for this information and wants to engage with us. And then interagency coordination is probably potentially the most valuable and most troubling component of this, working with county officials, with other state officials at Department of Pesticide Regulation, who's been really great, by the way, working with us, and also other state and federal officials is a really big component of it, so that we all know what we're doing and that we're bringing all the tools that we can bring to bear to solve this problem. Because it is an exponentially increasing water quality and water supply problem, and it's time for us to really engage on all cylinders. Drought, we support the Division of Water Rights. They're another one of my clients, just like the Regional Water Board here is. And so, again, the cannabis initiative is a really incredible opportunity to break down some of the silos between the Division of Water Rights and the regional boards, water supply, water quality. And you'll hear more about how our Sproul Creek inspections were really kind of the model and one of the best efforts we've had on that level to date at the water boards. But we support the Division Water Rights on all the curtailment orders they issued this year and enforcement of those curtailment orders, and then also assisting with drafting the emergency regulations that govern the water rights arena and trying to urge the board to adopt regulations that are enforceable. I wanted to mention this very briefly. I know you're familiar with it in the enforcement context. We have this notion of separation of functions, and what that essentially means is we have prosecution team and advisory team on enforcement matters that are adjudicated before you, where you're the decision maker. It's a principle of due process. It can be a hassle for small staffs, but it's very important to observe it to the extent practicable within your region so that the dischargers that are subject to enforcement get a fair and impartial hearing from the board. And the board is the last word on those. Well, I mean, the state board could be the last word on petition for review or a court maybe. But you really are the board that speaks here for the region and has your pulse on the needs and sense of the region. And so when we come before you, we want to make sure that the issues are focused not on fairness or due process, but on the actual water quality implications before the board. So what is the nature and scope of the discharge? Has the person made good faith efforts? Can they afford the penalty? Those are all things that are within your purview. And I probably misspoke when I said fairness, because we want it to be fair, but we don't want to be focused on procedural irregularities. We want to bring matters to you that are substantive in nature. Prioritizing enforcement's a big thing for us, and we've been working very closely with your staff on enhancing how we prioritize enforcement. And this is not just in your region, but in all regions. But there's a lot of investigations that go on that are at the staff level. And so that's kind of the main thing, inspections or investigations or follow-up on tips. You have an attorney liaison here at the region. In fact, in this region, you have three attorney liaisons. Myself, my senior prosecutor, Yvonne West, and then Vanessa Young from my office. So we're really focused on working with your staff here in the North Coast. These are not MMPs, of course, because we have a mandatory duty to do that. Your staff, and I think the other staffs, have basically developed good protocols for processing MMPs in an efficient and effective way. But this is how we use our other resources, what we do for other resources. We have regular prioritization meetings now in the region. It's essentially when we do sort of scoping and triage of the various matters that are arising up through the programs. The program managers participate. David Leland is the lead, and my attorneys are also present for those meetings, either telephonically or in person. We decide which cases need further compliance assistance, which cases can be delayed till the next meeting. Which cases, and that's based on resources primarily or severity, which cases need a notice of violation, maybe which cases are ready to ripen into administrative civil liability cases, what kind of relief or strategy are we going to take, what cases might need further investigation where we have a tip that maybe something more serious is going on than it appears on the surface. And then we always apply our enforcement tools in a progressive fashion. So this is a notion that I really want to emphasize and bring back with my people at the Office of Enforcement and with the regional boards, is we really want to focus on compliance assistance in our initial engagement with people who are in violation of their permit or water quality objectives. So I think that's our first line, and compliance assistance can last a few attempts. Sometimes it's an iterative process, particularly in this region where non-point source is such a critical, or non-point source is the majority of what you're addressing. Mm-hmm. So iterative process, but there's a point in that process where it can break down and compliance assistance no longer works. And that's when we want to escalate to a notice of violation, and we'll usually go there even before we go to an administrative civil liability action. So we want to make sure that by the time we're proposing a penalty for violations, we've given the discharger a really good chance to come into compliance, and for and despite their better efforts, I mean, if they've made good efforts, we're going to continue to work with them. But we're looking at people that haven't made an effort or haven't been successful at coming into compliance. So that's what I mean by progressive enforcement. And that'll be rewritten into the enforcement policy when we bring it back to the state board for authorization later this year. We look at these different types of factors. Every case is unique, but we're looking at what the threat to beneficial uses is, how sensitive is the water body, did violations continue after they were brought to the attention of the discharger, did they make a good faith effort to correct the violation, kind of what was the level of that. Are there facts mitigating the violations? Are there other external circumstances that may have been only partially or beyond the discharger's control that weigh into the continuing violations? What is the strength of our evidence, and how expensive and how much staff time would be required to develop further evidence? This is basically a factor of convenience and resource limitation. And then are enforcement resources available? So we look at these and other factors in determining where to focus our limited discretionary enforcement resources. Again, we have liaisons that are assigned to the office here. You have the three that I mentioned. The liaisons are not only available to participate in the monthly meeting, assisting the AEO and program leaders with prioritizing cases, but are also on call. So to maintain the separation of functions, they act as your legal counsel to your staff when something comes up that's just a regular question, like, I'm at the gate, can I go in? Things that that we wouldn't want to necessarily involve your advisory team attorneys in case the matter goes to a hearing, but they're just available on call as counsel for the enforcement staff and the enforcement team. And then I want to make this really clear, and this is something that I'm not sure is well understood throughout the boards. The Office of Enforcement acts as a legal advisor and sometimes technical advisors on some of the cases we're called in to assist on, to the assistant executive officer who makes all the strategic decisions on the case. So we advise, as your counsel advises you, when you're adjudicating or adopting a permit, but David is the decision maker on this. And I do want to say that David is one of the best at including staff in making those decisions and collaborating with the staff in making decisions. So he's not a command and control guy who just says, this is how it's going to be. Everyone has their say, and sometimes there's disagreement, and he makes the calls. So the process, again, we investigate. And let's talk a little bit about settlements, because most of the cases are settled. And our process is to bring settlements before the board to ratify as orders. And the reason we do that is so that they're more readily available, enforceable in the future if the terms of those settlement agreements are violated. So we'd like to have all our settlement agreements memorialized as board orders so that the board can enforce its own orders. So we do our investigations, we do our prioritization. If we decide that this is going to be an administrative civil liability action, we apply the penalty methodology, which I know you've used in the past and I've spoken about in the past. And then we engage with the discharger to talk about how we applied the methodology to get his, her, or its perspective on whether we appropriately analyzed all of the factors in assessing the civil liability. The policy itself recognizes that each case is unique and each region is unique to a certain degree, but we try to balance fairness and consistency in a transparent manner so that it doesn't pay to be a polluter or a discharger in a certain region, that we're capturing the economic benefit that the discharger obtains from the violations, and that it's not cheaper to do business in one region than the other because the penalties or civil liabilities are disproportionately applied. So it's a rough consistency approach, taking into account regional factors and considerations, as well as recognizing and acknowledging, as I think your staff and council does, that each case is somewhat unique, that we can't cookie-cutter apply factors in every case, or it doesn't make a lot of sense to sometimes. We engage with the discharger, then we reevaluate the methodology depending on the information that comes into us. When we're engaged in settlement discussions, we look at a reasonable range of outcomes. So we're not focused on a specific number, and it's hell or high water if we can't reach that number. We have a reasonable range of possibilities when we're engaged with the discharger, which we would accept. A lot of times that depends on which kind of score you might apply to a certain thing, how much the discharger thinks they can afford or ability to pay. So we look at a range of possibilities and we engage. If you see a settlement, that means the discharger and your enforcement staff came to a number that was within that range. Offers outside the range of comfort or that we think somehow violate the enforcement policy, we bring those to the board. And so our view is if we're going to get out of the range of our normal business practices and how we treat other members of the regulated public, then it should be up to the board to make those decisions. That the staff has a certain amount of discretion. Once we reach the limit of our comfort on the exercise of our discretion, then a matter might come before the board as a contested item. Some of the items that come in contested, not only are we outside the range, but we're not even talking to each other. So you may remember the Confusion Hill matter. That was one of those cases where we weren't outside the range, we just didn't agree. Contested ACLs that do come to the board, they're going to be on the medium to high end of the range when we present them to the board. Our engagement continues after we've issued the complaint and set the hearing schedule. And that what that means is we understand that coming before you is expensive and risky for both the discharger and the prosecution team. So if we can settle within the range that we had initially, we're still likely to settle the case. And oftentimes, the issuance of a hearing notice and a complaint is high-level motivation for the discharger to settle the case. It is the reality of the situation is setting in. We set out the hearing procedures, the briefing and evidence, and set the hearing date. And those, again, are very stimulating for settlement discussions. Stipulated orders, again, they're negotiated by the enforcement staff, your assistant executive officer, and consistent with the penalty methodology and the range I described. And then we ask the board to memorialize those as an order. And it's for several reasons. It's not so much just to make the requirement to pay the civil liability enforceable, but oftentimes we have a component, an injunctive component, where the discharger is required to do some work, fix their system. And of course, I should emphasize too, compliance is our first thought when it comes to enforcement. We need the discharger to come into compliance. That is first and foremost before we think about any of the other following penalties or other liability issues. So oftentimes, the pathway to compliance will be defined in an order that also contains a civil liability. Oftentimes, the settlement waives the right to a hearing on the allegations. Basically, we're coming before you. It's not a hearing. It's kind of a yes or no. If it's a no, we may come back to you with a hearing, and the settlement agreement would be out. The board always has the opportunity and authority to pull an item that is set to be settled off the settlement agreement calendar and ask that it be heard. So the board is always in a position to do that if you're dissatisfied. If you would like further explanation, aren't necessarily satisfied, you can ask us to take it off the consent calendar and have some discussion. So I urge the board not to feel that these settlement agreements that come before you are not a done deal, because we do want the board to be informed about what the meaning and consequences are, and also share our belief that the settlement agreement is within the range of possibilities or fair outcomes. The stipulation is between the discharger and the prosecution team, so it's like a contract or agreement, and then it becomes a regional board order once it's ratified by the board. The three key alternatives to assessing monetary liabilities are supplemental environmental projects, compliance projects, and enhanced compliance actions. And we're working really closely with your staff to try, and we can use up to 50% of the penalty money for supplemental environmental projects and enhanced compliance actions. And those are things that we're really looking to try to further with penalty money when we come before you. And then compliance projects are for MMPs in disadvantaged communities. And, of course, they can use 100% of the penalty money to apply towards a compliance project that's designed to remedy the violations for disadvantaged communities. So we want to get as much of these things going on in our penalty actions as possible. Of course, they're voluntary, so we cannot compel the dischargers to do them. I will represent to you, and I think David would do the same, we always search for a supplemental environmental project or an enhanced compliance action with every discharger. When you see a contested civil liability action that doesn't have one of these components in it, it's because the discharger has refused to engage with staff and discuss that. If you see a civil liability that comes before you and you're concerned that there should be a SEP or an enhanced compliance action, but there isn't because the discharger is contesting the matter, if you decide that the liability is appropriate, you're always able to make that determination that liability is appropriate, but leave the hearing open and allow for staff to go back and try to negotiate for an enhanced compliance action or a supplemental environmental project. That approach to life is much better than trying to adopt an enhanced compliance action or a SEP impromptu or on the fly in front of the board, because it allows the board and the discharger to explore the feasibility of the project, both from a funding perspective and a regulatory perspective, and also to assess its environmental benefit. So I urge you to exercise your discretion in those cases where you feel like, okay, this person is going to be fined $20,000, but we really think that staff should explore an enhanced compliance action or a supplemental environmental project. We're leaving the matter open. Return to us at the next meeting. So I urge you to exercise your discretion in that way when you feel that's an appropriate potential outcome. Again, methodology applies these various concepts of fairness, consistency, and transparency. A lot of about what we're trying to do here is show the regulated public, non-governmental organizations, the citizens of the state, show our work. How did we get from point A to the end liability? And a lot of that is just having appropriate findings that show your work. Of course, we want penalties to have a reasonable relationship to the gravity of the violation, the harm to beneficial uses. And also we want to make sure it's an appropriate deterrent, it provides an appropriate deterrent, because the facts are we can't catch everyone who's violating our regulations and laws. And so if you get caught, it just can't be a cost of doing business for getting caught. There has to be some motivating deterrent factor, which means some kind of a premium above and beyond what it costs just to be caught. And that's not just for the discharger, but to encourage others to voluntarily comply. So kind of the themes that we look for: fairness, consistency, and transparency in the application of the administrative civil liability process. So with that, I'll turn it over to Diana, and then we can take questions when she's finished her presentation.
Okay, moving to my script. Diana Henriel of your staff. I'll do a quick overview of enforcement activities in our region over the last few years. The last enforcement update I made to the board was in January 2012, and during that presentation, I gave you some background on this region's reasons for forming a dedicated enforcement unit, which we had done in 2005, some of the functions we were hoping that unit would serve, and a review of the activities that unit had been engaged in since its formation. The unit had spent its first few years dealing with the backlog of NPDES permit violations that were subject to mandatory minimum penalties, which was a legislative mandate and a performance criterion through the enforcement program. By the time I presented to you in 2012, we had caught up with the backlog and started a regular annual review of each of our dischargers under individual MPDES permits, which we had 48 such dischargers at the time. We had also, since about 2009, been picking up or expanding our activities in some of the other areas we'd hoped the unit would be involved in. Thank you. Including complaint tracking, interagency coordination, tracking and prioritizing violations, maintaining enforcement guidance and templates for the office, and working on high-level enforcement matters other than MMP cases. Also, our office had formed a spill response team. Since 2012, the enforcement-related updates we've given you have focused on our hot topic, discharges related to cannabis cultivation and site development, which you're going to hear more about today and in the months to come. But we've also managed to continue working on non-cannabis related activities, and I'm going to update you on a few of those right now. For the past couple of years now, we've had three dedicated enforcement unit staff, or now compliance assurance staff, Cecile Morris, Nancy Robinson, and Stormer Filer. Stormer is our complaint coordinator, and of course you know him as one of the charter members of our cannabis program. So the bulk of the MMP caseload is shared between Nancy and Cecile. At this point, we have about, I think we have 40 MPDES permits that require MMP reviews. And in the past few years, we've generally seen good or improving compliance at most of them. I think in our annual reviews, we're seeing that about half these dischargers have few or no violations. Maybe a quarter have a handful of violations and are usually something we can handle with expedited payment letters. And the remaining quarter may have numerous violations or more complicated issues to resolve. Our goal is to help dischargers find a way to take care of the underlying problems that are resulting in their violations. And sometimes the solutions are pretty expensive and can take a lot of time and effort to organize. Sometimes it can take years for us to resolve those more complicated cases. In my last update to you, I was talking about the Tule Lake case, which we're still working on the taking care of the final touches to resolve that. But I think that in the long run, it's worth it, the time that we spend putting these cases together and the projects that go with them. It's worth it both for our dischargers and for water quality. In addition to that work, we're assisting other units as needed on enforcement cases, assisting with ACLCs, bringing a few of those to the board, and you got to see a few over the past year. We had the Trinity Mobile Home Park and the Spring Hill Dairy, and you almost got to see Stormer's Yee case. I think you'll be seeing some more ACLs this year. David and Chinray kindly compiled some statistics and graphs to illustrate our enforcement accomplishments over the past 3 years. This covers the entire office, so it's not just work that's been done in the enforcement unit, but office-wide. You can see we had a total of a little over 100 enforcement actions. I think there's 109 there if I add it up. There was a mix of different enforcement tools that we used, our progressive enforcement. Focusing on the ACL orders that we've issued, we've assessed a total of about $2.3 million. About half of that was for MMPs. Looking at MMP specifically, we've issued 18 orders, complaints, or expedited payment letters covering a total of 745 MMP violations for a total of about $1.6 million. And you can see that most of those are associated with completed orders or expedited payment letters. We have a small amount outstanding in complaints we've issued, but not yet resolved at this time. Finally, of those penalties in completed orders, about two-thirds have been applied towards projects of one sort or another. And it's good to see the money applied to projects improving water quality and violations in our region. And about a third of the remaining third of the penalties have gone to the cleanup and abatement account. I'm going to show you a couple of recent projects in our region that were funded at least in part by assessed penalties. This is a big one here. This is the City of Rio Dell's upgrade of its treatment plant in 2013. Total project cost was $13 million. Rio Dell applied assessed MMPs, $366,000, towards the project. The overall improvements at the plant should ensure that the types of problems that led to the past MMP violations have or will now be eliminated. I understand that in November 2014, the city won the Plant of the Year Award from the North Coast section of the California Water Environment Association. So call that a success. Couple more projects. These are supplemental environmental projects. I believe they might be enhanced compliance. So they're not correcting specific problems that led to violations, but they are leading to overall benefits to water quality and beneficial uses. This is a project that the city of Eureka applied $43,000 of assessed penalties towards public education projects at the Sequoia Park Zoo in Eureka. That project included the Watershed Hero exhibit and some Watershed Play Interactives, fun things for the kids. And the city of Fort Bragg applied, they applied $14,000 of penalty money towards a $28,000 total project at one of their local parks, the Otis R. Johnson Wilderness Park. This project involved retrofitting three parking lots with permeable pavers and posting educational signage. That should be a good pilot project for treating polluted stormwater and providing some education about low-impact development. That's just a few examples, and in future updates, I'll tell you about more of the projects that we've overseen in our region. So what's up next is one slide to summarize a lot of words. So here we go. We're continuing to participate in county enforcement task force meetings and occasional joint inspections through our cannabis program. And with the help of the Office of Enforcement, we're building new partnerships with various agency staff and hope to coordinate even more closely on environmental crime investigation and enforcement. And we had great participation and cooperation last week with Office of Enforcement and Department of Fish and Wildlife, Division of Water Rights, California Geologic Survey, and the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office and Humboldt County Code Enforcement on our Sproul Creek Watershed inspections. With encouragement and assistance from OE, we have started to dig deeper into the task of identifying our region-wide enforcement needs and prioritizing water quality violations for enforcement. Up until now, our enforcement model has generally been reactive. In addition to reviewing NPDES cases, we do take up high-level enforcement cases where they're referred to us by other units or divisions, and we initiate enforcement cases when our complaint response inspections cause us to discover violations in the field. But what we haven't really done, either in my unit or more broadly as an office, is look through our regulatory programs and regulated facilities in general to assess compliance, identify categories of violations or enforcement needs, and compile and prioritize those. So it will become a more an enforcement prioritization exercise, and we're starting to do that, which is easy to say, but it's a lot of work to implement because it's talking to a lot of people and reviewing a lot of projects and a lot of files and a lot of cases. But with our recent staffing changes, a lot of new hiring, and a good overall look at our region's water quality protection and restoration priorities through the visioning process that Matt described earlier, the time is right and the willingness is there to start a systematic evaluation of our programs and see what's moving along well, what's been neglected because of more pressing projects, what could use some more enforcement attention to get on track or back on track. In the spirit of that new emphasis, our dedicated enforcement unit has now been renamed the Compliance Assurance Unit. So recently, we've been having meetings with various unit and division leads to look at cleanups, core reg programs, NPDES, stormwater, timber, and 401. And at the same time, we have been trying out some different ways to use our enforcement tools, in particular ACL complaints, and the application of the enforcement policies penalty methodology for discretionary violations. So we're trying a couple of different ways to use those and apply them. And I'm hopeful that we'll start to get more nimble in recommending penalties when they're warranted and as we start to have more cases that we're interested in pursuing. We'll also be working on some more fundamental efforts to strengthen the overall effectiveness of our regional enforcement activities. The Strategic Directions Enforcement Issue Group that we convened during the visioning process that Matt described earlier had a number of recommendations, some of which our Compliance Assurance Unit can help to implement. For example, we'll be reviewing the enforceability of permit language and providing recommendations to make sure that both new and updated permits are written in such a way that requirements are understandable and expectations are clear, so that it's easier to assess permit compliance and take enforcement when necessary. The enforcement work group also identified office-wide training needs for our staff, both new and existing. Compliance Assurance Unit staff will be working with staff from OE to provide in-house training on a number of topics over the next year or so, such as identifying violations, documenting inspection observations, writing effective inspection and enforcement reports, and putting together solid enforcement cases. And then hopefully with more comprehensive list of potential violations and enforcement priorities, we'll have some more opportunities for staff throughout the office to apply their training and get some experience working on enforcement cases. These are worthy goals, and I will update you on our progress probably later this year. And in the meantime, we'll continue to ramp up our cannabis program with lots of cooperation and help from OE staff. And I'll open it up to questions, and then Chris will go on to tell you more about our cannabis, statewide cannabis program.
Any board member comments or question? Well, I just, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to say I always was a supporter when the statewide did the enforcement unit. I know some regional boards felt it would impact their prerogatives or what, and I just think the combined effort here is one of, for a short period of time, one of the most outstanding efforts of making a state program work that I'm aware of. So just great job and tremendous compliments to you of getting it up and going, and you've made it almost exciting, and I think it's really upped our effectiveness, not just this board, but all of them. So just great job.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you want to respond, Chris?
Thank you, John.
Yeah, he'll argue with me.
Short and sweet. Well, I thank you, too. I mean, the Office of Enforcement and the development of the enforcement policy is actually a very powerful tool, right? That I agree that it adds consistency and transparency, and it adds very much a process. And I thank you for that. We see from time to time the outcomes of that. I'm also aware of the fact that, you know, our AEO, I don't want to call him a henchman, but, you know, I mean, he's always back there trying to get those, right, to get those. There's a lot of enforcement that we actually never see. In fact, the bulk of the enforcement we never see. And yet when you bring a case to us, your office, I should say, that's brought to us in a prosecutorial case, those have been quite interesting, right? That we, say like the last one we saw a range of options for us, which was the monetary option penalty at the end that, as I recall, went from $7,000 to $732,000, right? And you're asking us to figure out, and we were provided by a recommended number, which actually I believe we settled on. In other times, I recall we haven't exactly followed that manual very well, at least from the standpoint of walking through and having a really easy time getting to it, right? That I think that you brought up fairness a couple times, and I think that when we get a case, I look at it certainly from the lens of fairness. We are an agency with tremendous power and regulatory power, and yet the case is built on fact, actions, inactions, and outcomes here. And I think it's very, very interesting. I give you great kudos, by the way, that what your office has done with the UST Cleanup Fund. There's a fund that has put billions of dollars out on sites that I think has had very good effect in the bigger world. There's very, very much problems out there as well, as you're aware. At the same time, the UST world, which I personally work in as a professional, I would like to see some of the development of tools from the side of people that struggle with the compliance side, that struggle because there are a ton of mom and pops out here that get painted as a bad dog, and it affects the eligibility of the cleanup fund. And those projects to clean up a leaking tank site take a tremendous amount of money, and oftentimes money is the biggest problem. And yet we can't go forward because there is no money, and the fund won't give money because you're out of compliance. And that's a really tough thing. At the same time, I would tell you I'm interested in our end, from the regional board standpoint, in informal enforcement tools, right? To not have everything be a 10, not everything grinds through, of course, the enforcement manual. And I'm aware that that happens through the AEO, through Diana and her unit and that work. And I'm also interested to keep that money, if we have an infraction that's here local, I want to keep that. My interest is to fix the problems and just not write a check, right? I want to see that problem fixed. The early implementation in the Laguna TMDL process is actually developing, from what we've been told, a process which they can kind of have this range of projects that are separate projects out here. maybe they're not all set, but compliance-ready projects perhaps, where if we see this kind of thing, that we could stay in the watershed and have maybe qualified projects out here. I think it's all very interesting. I think at the same time, marijuana has and will continue to try every bit of enforcement, because enforcement really, if we look at it from a law enforcement standpoint, it really hasn't been able to curtail that activity at all. And yet, I give you great credit for the work that you've done, that you've stood beside us as an agency as we're kind of out front here, because this is a brand new world, and I think it will continue to try us. Again, I'm interested in some of the tools that we could develop for some and continue to develop for the enforcement as it is local. Education is certainly a component of that. It doesn't always have to be the stick. And with us, I think my interest is that, and I will retain the right as a board member to, if you bring it to me and ask me what we should do, that I will retain my discretion to what, if you ask me, I'll give you my honest answer at the end and enforce it as I see it. So I think enforcement is a very interesting process and tool, and it's necessary, absolutely. The very last thing is I don't want to see marijuana suck all enforcement wind out of this agency. Because my feeling has been, too, is that, and Diana, you brought this up, is that prioritization of enforcement, I think, is very key. We cannot have every bit of enforcement go towards marijuana. And yet the magnitude of that problem is readily apparent. MMPs are rather, to me, kind of perfunctory at this point. Those are pretty much lined up. Off of CWICs, you could pull them up. And the backlog, by the way, thank you for clearing the backlog. At the same time, there's a bunch of stuff on the in-between, and I'd like to see that priority, Diana. I really would like to see a prioritization and tools that can be developed that not everything's a 10 to go through enforcement.
There's a whole world we haven't even looked at
for
a long time. So, yeah, it's just peeking under the lid now.
Yes, and I think, and go back to the reorganization, right, that it's been, I think therein lies an opportunity to look at this process of regulatory and the outcomes that we want. Sure, we all want good water quality, and yet we're being challenged in ways we can't see and haven't seen before, and yet we still have this job to do to try and figure out how do we go about this. And I think strategically and tactically, enforcement's a very big tool in that. It's going to be very interesting to see how we go forward. I'm very interested to know, under that guise of prioritization of our efforts as an agency, how do we do that? And what tools do we have to do it, the tools we continue to develop for staff that we could use locally? But, Chris, I want to thank you again very much for your work and effort. Office of Enforcement has been a great partner, and I really do appreciate it. You've very much backed us up.
Thank you, and I want to represent that you can rest assured that we're interested in all of the programs here, my office is, and that we have resources we'll talk about that are dedicated to the cannabis enforcement, but that shouldn't be impacting the other programs except where they overlap, and there are some overlaps with 401 and other programs. Mm-hmm. So we understand the pilot project is what it is, and we have funding for it, but it shouldn't affect our timber harvest enforcement, our vineyard enforcement, our dairy enforcement, or any of the other. And I don't single those out. They're just coming to mind.
No, right. That's
all
part of the world.
All the programs need a firm hand and compliance assistance going forward. So we want to make sure that we're applying our resources in all those areas.
Well, and again, thank you. And Diana, I would ask that if there is a schedule to be put towards somehow to look towards prioritization, that you come back and talk to us about that. Because I think that we oftentimes see kind of the pieces and parts of enforcement. But yet it is a very important piece of what we do. It's been rebranded now as compliance assurance, which is interesting. That's softer. At the same time, it is what it is, right? Because we want to assure that there's compliance with water quality and the continued improvement of protection. Mm-hmm. That's what we all want. How do we go about it? I'm very interested.
I won't be changing my office's name.
Okay. OE sounds pretty good, man. That rolls right off the tongue. Yeah.
Any other board member comments or questions? Yeah, I just had one. Chris, I want to make sure you hear this. I know we had a private conversation where I said if it was appropriate, you should go ahead and issue the subpoenas, and we consider that just part of your normal discretion at this regional board level. Because I understand some regional boards have said never, never do that, and we're saying use it as an appropriate tool, and I just wanted to get that on the public record.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? I'm going to do just a little bit of housekeeping. Do board members need a break, or can we go to 12? Okay, if no one asked for a break, we're going to 12. two administrative staff asked that I get ready, give them notice for lunch, and we're going to have lunch at 12, and then at 12:30 we're going to meet for executive session, and then we'll come back into hearing whatever we haven't heard at 1 o'clock. So was that clear enough direction to you? And then I'm hoping, and I don't want to cut anyone short, but that we can do this in 55 minutes or less. Thank you.
Matt gave me a lot less time than that.
Yeah.
I'm convinced of the wisdom of our executive officer on this matter.
Me too. I promise not to to put my lawyer hat back on and fill the time that you gave me if it's not needed.